Mr. Mason, reel 6.
Can you see the DZ? He said, no, I can't see a thing. So I said, well, you should, because back at Colombo, the conducting officer, when I asked him what sort of a DZ it was, he said, oh, quite big. He said, as big as Wembley Football Stadium. So we were flying round, and this time, of course, the pilot was dropping our supplies, the containers, with my radio set and various other bits of equipment. And then this chap in front said, well, I can see something that looks about the size of number one court at Wimbledon, which sounded pretty small to me. So our turn came and the green light came on and out we shot. There was no question of jumping. We just put our feet together and slid down the slide. Very low altitude, actually. Not more than about 500 feet. So our parachutes opened and, of course, we parted from each other in the air. And within seconds, I crashed through the trees and the parachute caught in the trees. That sort of slowed me down. Chute being caught in the branches, which I suppose someone broke off, and I didn't come down all that fast. And then on landing, I hit a log, which was across a stream, and shot off this log up to my waist in water, feeling quite happy, really, to be on the ground at all. And then I heard various shouts in the distance, and could almost feel people approach me, and two Chinese dressed in uniform. First thing I noticed was the three-star badge in their caps. They looked like Japanese to me. But they jumped into the water and released me from my harness and helped me to the side of the stream, lifted me out.
What was the significance of the three stars?
Well, that's the Chinese communist guerrilla badge. It's called Tiger Bintang, three stars. There again, I've got a badge belonging to them, which was presented to us. Each of us had to wear that three-star badge, or we were told to, or asked to. So they directed me back to this clearing. Well, now, the clearing was simply half an acre of ground. The trees had been chopped down, but leaving great stumps sticking up, spikes of wood all over the place. Anyway, by this time the other two had gathered. They'd landed quite safely. Same thing, right in the trees. No trouble at all. No damage. Just me with a damaged foot. And I hobbled up to this man on the ground, a major named Hislop. And he said some sort of greeting. And I said, I don't think much of your DZ, and he said, oh, that's not the DZ. He said, if you dropped in there, you'd been killed. I said, well, where were we supposed to drop? He said, well, where you did, amongst the trees. Which I thought was quite funny. Well, I didn't think it was quite funny, really. We were never told that we were going to be dropped amongst 150-foot trees. And 150 feet sounds like that's a minimum height of some of these trees. Enormous trees. Anyway, our kit was gathered. There were a number of communist guerrillas there, all in uniform, all wearing this same three-star badge. And they helped us with our kit, and I was hobbling along. We hobbled up a stream for about an hour or so, until we reached this jungle camp. And there was quite a good setup there, with palm leaf huts had been built. There was a cooking area. There was a radio shack covered in palm leaves. But by this time it was dark or dusk, and someone had prepared a sort of bed or bits of tree or bamboo or whatever. I put my sleeping bag onto that, and the doctor, who was at the station at the time, came to have a look at my leg and said, well, it's too dark for me to do anything tonight. I'll have a look at it in the morning. Do you want a sleeping pill or a shot or something? I said, no, it's not that bad. And so I slept quite well. And early next morning he came to where I was lying, and I was in an American-type sleeping bag or cover, green outside with a whitish nylon, some sort of rayon or nylon interior. And when I zipped it open, the doctor was absolutely horrified to find that there were about eight or nine things which were like large sausages in bed with me. They were actually leeches that had been feeding on me all night. Strange enough, leeches, although I saw millions of them later, they didn't worry me anything like as much as lice. I hated the lice. Leeches I could put up with. I had quite a few on me after that. The jungle was infested with them. And these had finished feeding. They were quite comatose, so we just sort of chucked them out and somebody chopped them up. And anyway, the doctor looked at my thought I'd broken a bone, decided to plaster me up. So out came the plaster of Paris and the bandages, and plastered up my foot up to my knee. And then I was able to get up, and someone made me a bit of a crutch, and I hobbled about. But unfortunately the plaster wouldn't set because of the damp conditions, and the whole lot gradually moved down, and I finished up with a great wadge of bandage and plaster around my ankle, so we had to take that lot off. And as the doctor said, well, I can't do anything more about it except bind you up. Fortunately, after a few days, the pain went, and we concluded it was just a bad sprain, hitting this log. If you hit something one-footed when you're coming down in a parachute, it's always trouble, you know. You really want both feet to hit the ground at the same time. If you hit a rock with one foot or a piece of wood or something, it usually leads to trouble. That's where most people get broken legs and that sort of thing. So I felt quite fit, and that night, that evening, or the next evening I think, I set up my set again in the hut there that they'd built, connected everything up, threw the aerial over a tree, waited until the exact moment, switched on, listened on the frequency, and heard the base station at Colombo coming through very loud, loud and clear. And then when I replied, they picked me up straight away. So communication was established immediately. And it was a bit unusual because the very next signal we received was to congratulate me on getting through so quickly. Which I'd never heard of before. Anyway, they seemed to be quite pleased back in Colombo. And so there we stayed in the jungle. There were a number of Chinese with us. The CO at that time was a Major Hislop, who was an ex-rubber planter, like a lot of these SOE officers at the time. They spoke Malay and Tamil, usually, a bit of Chinese, some of them. And they were commissioned, probably in India or Ceylon, and sent into Malaya. Same thing applied to Burma. His second in command, a captain, I think he was an ex-Malayan tin miner. Our doctor, who I've mentioned, Dr. Dumoulin, who had parachuted in, I don't know how long before me, but not too long before me. He was the doctor, of course, who tried to fix my leg. And he, as I said, later became a very well-known consultant gynecologist at Plymouth Area Hospital. But I have spoken to him once on the telephone, but I've never been in touch with him or any of the others. I'm not sure, the date's sort of very vague now, how long I stayed up there, but at some time in the period the atomic bomb was dropped, or two of them dropped on Japan, and of course we somehow knew that the war would then be over. And of course we were delighted, naturally, because as far as I was concerned, when I went in, I could have been in that jungle for many months. We just don't know how long we might have been there. And the idea of the missions in the jungle was not so much sabotage, but obtaining intelligence, Japanese movements, troop movements, the state of the defences on the beaches, and we had native agents who discovered that sort of information, who would come back and tell us south of Penang, a mile from the beach, would be a battery of 105mm guns, say, machine gun posts here, and so on and so forth. And all that intelligence would be sent back to Colombo, because, of course, there was an invasion planned for the west coast of Malaya, just south of Penang. And this is mainly, or was mainly, the job of SOE in the jungle. At the time when the invasion took place, or when it took place, then SOE would come out and commit various acts of sabotage at strategic points. This was the general plan. But, of course, it was never necessary. One of the officers, I forget his name, unfortunately, a week or so after the atomic bomb had dropped, the atom bomb had dropped, went down through the jungle to Baling, which was the regimental headquarters of quite a large Japanese group, to ask for the surrender, and to ask for their surrender. And they just sent him away, told him to clear off. Nothing was done to him. They just said, go back into the jungle, we're not surrendering to you, you see. And I think he was awfully brave to go down there, really, to do this. Anyway, he came back, reported back, and said that they were not surrendering at the moment. And then later, I think, a few days later, it was the Supreme Commander made his famous broadcast calling on all Japanese troops to lay down their arms, and in the name of the Emperor, to surrender unconditionally. So it was decided we would move down again, which we did. We left our heavy gear in the jungle in charge of the Chinese, and then we moved out, and after a day's march, slithering and sliding through the jungle, there were simply no tracks up there at all. We got down to a place which was on the map called the Wooden Bridge, which is the end of the metal road which led to Baling. And after negotiation with the local Japanese, a lorry was provided, and we were then driven into Baling, where we were accommodated in the village school. But we were told not to wander around. They still hadn't decided locally whether to continue the fight. We were told not to wear arms. We weren't disarmed, but we were told not to wear arms. And we were simply confined to the school for perhaps 3 or 4 days. And then finally, the Japanese general in command in northern Kedah decided that this was enough, and he officially surrendered. And I remember going to a large house near Sungipatani to witness the surrender of the local Japanese troops.
What did it look like?
Unimpressive. The Japanese general appeared in tiny man in a scruffy, greeny-grey tunic and trousers with a peaked cap. The only insignia of rank the Japanese wear is a tiny patch over their breast pocket. From lance corporals to generals just have this little tiny rank badge on their field uniforms. And he arrived in a truck, not a car, just an ordinary truck, sitting next to the driver, a major general, and came into the room where, by this time, Colonel Alexander had taken over from Hislop. I think Hislop had done something he shouldn't do, or he shouldn't have done, and he was replaced, and DRW Alexander actually took the surrender in this house from this Japanese general.
What had Hislop done?
He'd upset the local Tiga Bintang communist guerrilla leader. And this leader had complained to higher authority, complaining about his treatment. Of course, we had to step pretty warily at the time, because they had all the arms. The communists had all the arms. Now, during the surrender, it was agreed that the Japanese should keep their small arms and would stay on guard and see that there was no local uprising and do the same as they did before. And until the British forces arrived in Malaya to take over. And this is what happened. They were so well disciplined, these Japs, that they just kept control over everything.
Do you think there was any likelihood of a local uprising?
Well, absolutely. I think this is what the communists were looking for. I mean, we'd supplied them with modern weapons, explosives, all sorts of armament, Brens, they had the lot. There again, they were so split and divided that no natural leader seemed to be around to get them going. And of course their communication wasn't very good. Up to this time, they'd been relying on information that we got over our Wallisets, you see. Communication between the groups wasn't all that good. It couldn't be in the jungle. They were spread out from sort of Singapore right up to the Siamese border in small units. Had they been massed together in some central point, then the story could have been quite different, armed as they were. Before they could get themselves organized, a brigade from India, who would have been part of the original Malayan invasion, came over and actually landed on the beaches in below Penang. And that was a pretty traumatic experience, because even after all the intelligence had been sent about the state of the beaches and the tides and that sort of thing, naval people were concerned as well. Many of the landing craft and even one or two of the destroyers finished up on the sandbanks, high and dry, and couldn't be moved until the tide came in. So who was to blame for that little fiasco? No one knows. Anyway, eventually they landed. The brigade, I think it was 74th Indian Brigade, landed under a brigadier, who then organized and took the formal surrender of the Japanese on Sungipatani airfield. The officers came and laid down their swords, enormous pile of swords, in front of the surrender base where the brigadier was. But that wasn't really the end of it, because the same brigadier had to take his brigade, or was supposed to take his brigade, to Indonesia to sort out some trouble. And I don't know whether this is in the history books. But because by this time a lot of his men in the brigade, especially the British, were due to go home to be discharged, you see, because they'd come to the end of the time, he actually took a regiment of Japanese soldiers with him into Indonesia to make up his brigade. And it's said that he said afterwards that they were or had been the finest troops he'd ever commanded, which didn't amuse his seniors. But this is actually what happened. And the made-up brigade went over to Indonesia. I don't think they stayed there very long. The trouble was soon over. But what happened to them after that, I don't know.
What had Hislop said to the communist leader to offend him?
I think it started that by this time we were in the school, and this is actually what happened. The leader of the communist guerrillas in that area came into Baling to see Hislop. Now, I suppose I was responsible in one way, because he'd told me to man a brain gun by the gate and to stop anyone coming in. And about the first person that tried to get in, and Hislop was with me at the time, and he must have expected this chap, and he forbade him to come into the school. And I had the gun virtually pointed at this communist guerrilla and his little crowd of supporters. And I could see the shock in this bloke's face when he saw this brain gun pointing at him. And he left immediately. And very shortly afterwards, he must have got in communication with somebody or other, because Hislop very rapidly disappeared. And as I say, Major, as he was then, D.R.W. Alexander, took over. He was a super chap. Everybody liked Alex, as he was known.
What was so good about him?
A very understanding, but tough sort of an individual, who would stand no nonsense. We admired him because he spoke Hindi or Hindustani perfectly. For what he'd been, he joined the COSBYs, King's Own Scottish Borderers, and had stayed with them as a private soldier for several years, and was posted to Hong Kong, where he was employed in a foreign office department in Hong Kong as a sort of interpreter or something or other for anyone that came along that couldn't speak English. And if he could talk to them in German, Italian or Spanish, he could, you see. And still as a private soldier and getting a private soldier's pay. Well, as he said, he got rather fed up with this, and the only way he could get out of it was to apply for a commission, which he did, and was accepted, and sent back to India. Now, in India, he joined, of course, the Indian Army, and one of the things that the officers had to do was to speak Hindi. Well, he was so good at his languages that he passed his first and second class certificate in the time that half the officers were only just starting on the course, you know. He really was tremendously good after a few months. And then they made him a teacher to the British troops, you see, which he didn't like. He thought, well, here we are, back to the old days. I'm just another interpreter, you see, another teacher. But this time, as I say, he was commissioned lieutenant, I suppose. And then he joined a tank regiment. I know this from the history of the book on the regiment, called the Carabineers. But he didn't stay with them long. He then volunteered for SOE. And then he did his jungle training, and he was parachuted into Malaya. He quickly got promotion, captain, then acting major. And then, the time we left, he got his other pip, lieutenant colonel. And we were all, you know, delighted for him. Because he's had such a poor start in life. As I said, he'd done his degree, he got his degree in modern languages, university, but it had done him no good at all before the war. So this was a great boost for him, you know. After the war, I believe he became a district officer in Africa. I had one Christmas card from him, I sent one to him, and, you know, that was it. So, whether he's still alive, still serving, I doubt it. He's older than me. He's probably 75-ish. Well, he might still be about. As I say, he was a super chap. Now, after the surrender, all of us, I think there were by this time 13 SOE members assembled in Sungiputani, and we were all presented with a Japanese sword by the Brigadier of the 74th Brigade, saying that, well, we'd been there the longest, and we deserved one apiece, you see. So we were presented with a Japanese sword, which is one of the few souvenirs I've got left. Well, more or less that was the end of it. We returned to Singapore, and from Singapore we went by troop ship to Calcutta, by train to Delhi, then Meerut, which was SOE headquarters 100 miles or so northwest of Delhi, I suppose. And there we were disbanded. And as they said, we were RTU'd, returned to our units. And my unit, Royal Signals, was in Mau, in central India. And from Mau, I was posted to Karachi, to the 2nd Indian Airborne Div, Signals. And there I stayed for the last few months until I was due for my discharge. Came back to England, and didn't quite know whether to stay on. I'd been offered a commission and so on and so forth to stay on. I'd been offered a commission before. But this time it would have been a permanent commission because possibly the unit I was to be commissioned in would have been off to Korea or something like that. Anyway, I came home to Weston and to think about things and met my friend Jean, who I'd known since I was 14. We were both 14 when we first met. And decided...